It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Hello and welcome back to Out of Office. Today, I bring you the backstory of a leader, Kamal Ahmed, founder of the Asian University for Women, or AUW, who found himself tasked with something he could never have imagined, evacuating 149 AUW students and alumni out of Afghanistan.
So one of the most frustrating parts for me was I was not there. If something went wrong, I would somehow still live. But these girls faced the full enormity of the situation.
And I bring you the story of 23-year-old AUW student Sarah Sultani, who demonstrated extraordinary courage as the girls risked their lives to make it out of Afghanistan on a flight Kamal helped to organize.
All I can say about getting out of Afghanistan is that it was a miracle that we could get out of there.
Based in Bangladesh, AUW, founded in 2008, is a university for women from displaced communities. Many of the girls who attend are the first in their families to go to college. Most are from Bangladesh. The second largest student body is from Afghanistan.
I have never been ashamed of being an Afghan, but I always think I would be a different person and a better person if I was grown up in a different country. I always feel like living in Afghanistan has taken many of the opportunities that I was supposed to have in my life. Not only opportunities, it has even taken from me the basic rights I need to have as a human, like the rights of having freedom, the rights of having a better quality of education, the rights of living in peace.
I first spoke to Kamal a few years ago when I lived in Hong Kong, and I've supported AUW students by occasionally mentoring some of them. You'll hear from Kamal in a moment. But first, here's Sarah with her story of how she made it out of Kabul. She's currently at a U.S. Air Force base, safe and relieved.
All I can say about getting out of Afghanistan is that it was a miracle that we could get out of there. We started our journey on 25th August, and the most difficult thing in this journey was to get inside the airport, since there were Taliban standing in all the gates, and they were not allowing people to go inside. We all students were inside the buses for almost 2 days behind the airport gates. On 26 August, a massive explosion had happened in two different gates of the airport. So I think it was a miracle for us, which we were all safe. However, more than 60 persons have died that night on that explosion, since there was a chaos going on near to the airport. The U.S. soldiers did not agree to come out and take us inside, so we moved back to our houses that night. And then tomorrow, on 27 August, we went again to the airport gates, and again we remained there for another night. Believe me, it was not even safe for 150 girls to stay in the street at night, as there were Taliban's checkpoint in almost every station. Anything could happen to us. Anytime we could die. We knew that, but we were still continuing our journey. And finally, tomorrow early morning on 28, we could finally go inside the airport with the help of Mr. Kamal, who has arranged everything very well this time, so we could go inside safely, and we are very, very thankful for him.
But before they could get on a plane, they had to make it past the Taliban checkpoints.
We all were standing in front of the Taliban, and there was one Talib who was calling our names one by one to pass us from the checkpoint. I was shaking, my hands were shaking while showing my passport to the Taliban. After that, the Taliban accompanied all of us to the U.S. military checkpoint. At the end, when we reached the U.S. military checkpoint, the Taliban has said something to all of us, which I would never forget it. He said, "We, Taliban, are now done with our responsibility toward you, and now you're free to go to your Lord." He was using the word Lord, referring to the U.S. military. When I sat to the airplane, I didn't have any idea about my future. I didn't know where we would land. All I had in my mind, which made me happy, was being safe from all the Taliban. And that was enough for me at that moment.
Meanwhile, Kamal was working the system behind the scenes. I asked him how he got them out. Here's my conversation.
Thank you, Malika. When we got word of the sort of the coming attractions in Afghanistan, if you will, in around the end of June, we made a commitment that we will not only evacuate all of our Afghan students, but also offer the same opportunity to the graduates of this university. And specifically for the graduates, we created a new master's in education program. So if they chose to come back to AUW, they would actually be plugged into a serious, structured graduate program with the idea that Afghanistan, if not tomorrow, the day after, will need women who are better trained, who can deliver on the promise of a better future for the country. But we did not anticipate how fast things are going to unravel.
So this took you by surprise.
This took us very much by a surprise, because the original plan was, you know, that they will all get vaccinated, they will do all the visa applications. One of us were to go pick up the passports of all the students and alumni from Kabul, run to Uzbekistan, where there is a Bangladesh embassy, and then bring back the passports and load them on a commercial airline to come back to AUW in Bangladesh. I was supposed to be in Afghanistan on August 14th. I was ready to board my flight from Istanbul to Kabul when I got a text saying the flight has been canceled. So that's when we quickly needed to shift our ideas and strategies on how to get our students and alumni out. And commercial flights were no longer operating. And the threat of the Taliban became much more apparent. What we did is we asked the government of Bangladesh that under the circumstances, there was no way to get visas from its embassy in Tashkent. So we needed to get a guarantee that these students will be given visa on arrival. Fortunately, within 45 minutes of our formal request, the government issued a note saying the 170 students and alumni that we wanted to bring back would be allowed to have visa on arrival.
That's fantastic.
Yes. So that made really two challenges. One was to get a plane that would come to Kabul and pick them up. And perhaps a greater challenge in figuring out how to get 170 women out of different locations in Kabul into the airport, past some 13 or 14 Taliban checkposts, more checkposts at the airport, and then inside the airport, which by then became the only safe place in Afghanistan. So those are the sort of challenges at that point on August 14, 15 that we were faced with. And we needed to do something right away because nobody could predict how bad things would get, but we knew things would get bad.
It took about 2 days though, right, for the girls to actually get inside the airport and make it out. It was a really harrowing experience, wasn't it?
Yes. It took 5 days. It's only at the end
wow.
of the day in a convoy of 7 buses that they managed to get inside the airport. So it was really 5 days, almost 24 hours every day that we were in different stages of either advancing towards the airport or going sideways, waiting when the next gate would open and they would be allowed in. Of course, all this happened while the Taliban's, unknown Taliban's, we don't know, where they came from exactly, were on the streets with guns toting, firing up in the air, fortunately not at us. And on the second time when our students were close to the airport in the middle of the night, the explosions happened at the airport. So they were just meters away from where all of this happened and could see, would certainly hear the blast, could feel the vibration and see the flames that came out of the blasts.
I heard from one of the girls, one of your students, and she described what she saw. So I understand what they went through. But one of the things that struck me is she kept saying, you know, Kamal had organized this for us. We knew he would get us out. We knew he would get us out. A, I imagine you felt extraordinary pressure to get them out safely. How much of a challenge was this to you as a leader?
I wish I had this particular student's level of certainty about a successful outcome. But frankly, we didn't. So we were very nervous. We felt it was not a one-sided risk. If we didn't do anything, we were also playing with a lot of other risks. It became clear that we had a short window and we needed to act within that short window. And we mobilized every ounce of resources we had to make that as successful as we could. Now, a lot of things could have gone wrong. It could have had a completely different result than ultimately what we got. But we felt compelled that we had to take this. And this decision was not mine alone. Every day we would consult with all of the students, their parents, sometimes, is this what you want to do? And at the end, some students and their families didn't want to do this. So they dropped out, which was fine. So we still have another 25, 30 students who are still in Kabul.
How testing was it for you as a leader?
Well, we have never faced a situation where a decision could result in a situation of life or death.
Correct.
We have dealt with sort of economic decisions or other welfare decisions, but never one that involved somebody else's life. It is one thing to even have responsibility for your own life, which I think is relatively easy. But when you have to, in some ways, have a preponderance of influence in others' decisions that only affect their lives, but not yours. So one of the most frustrating parts for me was I was not there.
Yes.
I was, if something went wrong, I would somehow still live. But these girls faced the full enormity of the situation.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
What kept moving you forward? What kept going through your mind at that time?
I mean, you know, there was really two things. We were not debating whether we were going to get this thing done or not. The only thing we focused on, how do we get this done? We knew we had to get the Taliban support to get our students through the checkposts. We knew once they were at the airport or even before the airport, the support of the American government was crucial. You know, unless our convoy of seven buses of all Afghan nationals did not get escalated into a high priority for the US government, we would not make through that checkpoint, even if the Taliban's allowed. And it was a strange situation. It was not like a bifurcated Taliban approval and an American approval. It was, in some strange ways, there was a combined effort. So the desk of the Taliban's were right next to the Americans. If the Taliban agreed and the Americans didn't, it wouldn't work, nor would it work the other way around. So we had to get both of those parties to say, this is important, let them pass.
So you actually were able to connect with the Taliban command?
Certainly, we had to reach their networks.
And they gave the green light for the girls to make it to the airport.
I mean, they didn't give us the green light per se, but they said, you should proceed.
And the rest
it was up to us to interpret what that meant, and we really weren't sure.
But every year, the number of students you have at AUW, quite a few of them do come from Afghanistan, right?
Absolutely. It is, after Bangladesh, the second largest source of students for us, by design, because we felt all along, of all the places we serve, Afghanistan needed this type of education programs most.
Now, when you look ahead, are you worried about girls in Afghanistan, girl students in Afghanistan?
I mean, we are very worried. When I hear other people say, oh, this time it'll be different, I don't know on what basis people say, this time it's going to be different. It's the same people. In some cases, it's the sons taking the places of the fathers. But that's all that's different. Already you see a new government, a new cabinet. One of the first things they say, women cannot play cricket. In its absurdity, it is really telling that what are the priorities of a government that has so much at his hands.
You talked about the girls demonstrating extraordinary grace. And you say grace under pressure that you haven't seen before. And you went on to say in an open letter, even myself as a child of a civil war of my own Bangladesh. Tell me a little bit about your own background when you say you're a child of a civil war in your own country. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, in 1971, I was 6 years old, and that's when the civil war started in Bangladesh. And my parents were university professors, so we lived on the campus of the university, which in some ways became the epicenter of that civil war. You know, we saw, although we were not persecuted or violently attacked, all around us, we saw how people turn against each other, people who have been friends. Suddenly, in a civil war context, they become enemies. We saw the violence of it just peering through the windows outside of, you know, people being lined up, brush fired on, then buried, you know, that sort of thing. That was the sort of the stuff of our childhood. So you would think that I had enough of a preparation for more of these settings, but you're never really prepared. And as I said, the real challenge here was it was somebody else's life. You know, in the context of the civil war in Bangladesh, it was us. We were not responsible. We were not influencing other people's lives. Here, we found ourselves in a situation where we had to decide for somebody else.
So your parents worked at the university. You come from a family of educators. You grew up on a university campus. Was it just inevitable that you would then spend your life in trying to offer education to people who don't normally have access to it?
God, I don't really believe in inevitability of anything, but obviously I was very conditioned to think about education as an instrument for freedom. It was quite apparent in the context of the lives that we lived. And I had a natural, if you will, affinity to that idea.
You had a very elite education yourself. Phillips Exeter Academy on the East Coast in the United States, Harvard, Michigan Law School. What drew you to establish AUW and basically commit your life to a life of service, of giving women, young women, a doorway, access to education that they wouldn't have a chance to otherwise?
That's a complicated question.
Let's try to simplify it. So how do you think your rather elite education influenced your own views towards education?
I would say, in spite of the elite education, as you say, I have had, I remained committed to the early conditionings of our lives. I saw the education that I was fortunate to get not necessarily as a pathway into something conventional, perhaps, but something that also gave me access to do things that I felt were important. It is because of my friends at Exeter and Harvard and Michigan that I was able to reach a lot of people, even in the context of the most recent experience with the evacuation of the Afghan students. We were able to, within hours of trying, we were able to get through to the White House, to the Deputy Secretary of State in the State Department. We were able to reach military folks. We were able to mobilize tremendously, and in part because of our access that came with the institutions that I was certainly fortunate to have been a part of.
It's the networks, right, that you established through these places.
Yes.
You said something interesting a few moments ago. You said you believe education is an instrument for freedom. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think two things. One is, I think one of the biggest impediments in overcoming oppression is unawareness of how oppressed you are. If you're not aware of your own situation vis-a-vis perhaps others, then you're not at the gates to do something about it. But even when you become aware of your situation, you need certain instrumentalities to try to overcome that measure of oppression. And as I think of it, education is what helps us to fight it, to overcome it probably in the most effective way. You and I are both from the former British Empire. The education of the leaders who led the movement for home rule in India, I think, was incredibly important. I can't imagine a similar movement occurring without that type of education. Once you're educated, it is hard to be put down. It's also, you have a better sense of what your comparative advantages are in overcoming whatever has been restraining you. So that's why I think of education as really as a discovery of freedom, but also an instrument for attaining freedom.
What strikes me is you're a real doer, and in many ways an agitator. It feels like you've always been trying to push the boundaries and do something and create something new. When you were a freshman at Harvard, you founded and directed the Overseas Development Network, a consortium of K-12 campus organizations devoted to development. As a teenager, you founded a series of primary schools for working children in Dhaka. What drives you to keep giving or creating organizations that are basically built around service and helping others?
You ask difficult questions. I think part of it is really, I go back always to the environment in which I grew up. It's the environment of seeing sort of undescribable needs coupled with the optimism that you can actually help change them. That my parents certainly emphasized for each of us. And then, you know, once you get started, I was 13 years old when I first started a school. Once you've had that experience, it becomes a preoccupation. You can't get rid of it. When I came to college in the US, I was struck by how little people knew about the kinds of lives that I had seen as a child and as an adolescent. So it became important to try to share that, and to share that in an order of magnitude higher than just your personal relationships required a creation of an institution, of an organization, and we did that. So I followed essentially that pattern. I thought creating a university would be easy because we grew up on one and I thought I knew something about it. Mm-hmm. But of course, sometimes, you know, what you think is easy is not so easy. And we're still struggling, as you know, to try to build this institution.
Tell us a little bit about where AAUW is today. For someone who's never heard of the Asian University for Women before, if you had to give them an overview, an introduction, tell us a little bit about it.
Yes. So Asian University for Women is in Chittagong, Bangladesh. We started in 2008. It's a liberal arts and sciences institution that is focused on bringing young women, particularly women who are first in their family, to get into a university with the idea that the life experiences of these women combined with the education that we are able to provide would prompt them to take on challenges in their own communities and impact in a way that individual pursuing their own careers and paths would not. So our hope is that we would create a larger network of young women leaders from communities of unsuspecting backgrounds. What do I mean by unsuspecting backgrounds? We use the phrase, perhaps borrowed from liberation theology, that we exercise a preferential option for women who come from oppressed communities. The reason we had so many Afghan students is because we felt very strongly that this is a community that needed the support of such an institution. And we went all out to all 34 provinces of Afghanistan to recruit these students. We have 125 Rohingya refugees who, in most cases, have never seen anybody, men or women, in from their villages, from families, to get to a university. And, you know, part of it is also the notion that if you are part of an oppressed community, maybe a reflection of that oppression is you never get to speak for yourself. It's always somebody else telling your story, somebody else who is representing you. So part of the educational agenda for the university has been to enable these young women to speak for themselves, speak about what they want and what they suffer, and not be mediated by somebody else's voice or perception. So that's been the goal. We have 1,100 students from 18 countries, overwhelmingly first in their families to ever come to university. We hope this is a setting where certain values get cultivated, values that emphasize equality, non-discrimination, and the ethos that really we're all equally gifted, or we lack gifts equally, and we are empowered. We have the agency to make all the change that we want to. So this is a different kind of university in that sense, that we have a social purpose. We measure our success not necessarily only on academic achievements of our students, although that is very important, but also in terms of how they try to change the direction of societies they come from.
And that brings me to my last question, and that's about leadership. How do you create an atmosphere, an ethos at a university that really focuses on creating the next generation of leaders?
It's a whole process that we try to follow. Because of the particular orientation of the university, we set out three primary characteristics that we would look for in the admission of students. They are courage, because leadership in the context where we work in cannot happen unless you're able to step out of your normal shoes and demonstrate a large measure of courage. Second, we say you cannot be a leader unless you're outraged by injustice. If you don't feel outraged by the conditions of people who are suffering or something akin to that, then maybe you've already lost something that is not going to enable you to become a leader. And the third one is sort of a corollary of the second, which is, how do the woes of other people inspire, trigger you to do something to be of assistance? I guess the sentiment here is, do you have a measure of empathy for others? So those are the traits: courage, outrage at injustice, and empathy that we look for in every student coming in. And then the next 4 or 5 years that they spend in the university, they're encouraged to develop it, to articulate it, to really be embedded in it, so that what happens next sort of becomes an instinctive. So when you see somebody in trouble, you get the courage to do something about it. And because you care, you will do the best you can in each of those situations.
Before we wrap up, I'd like to bring Sarah back and let her have the last word.
I think takeover by the Taliban, not only for me, but for most of the women in Afghanistan, means a fall after more than 20 years of rising. We Afghan women, especially those of women's rights activists, have worked for the women's rights for more than 20 years and had a lot of outstanding achievements. With the Taliban taking over Afghanistan, all these achievements have been destroyed. Now we need to start everything from the opine, fighting for our basic rights. I personally think if I stayed in Afghanistan in this situation, I would be able to manage my life and live somehow. I would not have that motivation to continue working again for my rights and for other women's rights. I would not have that strength to start all this way again from the opine. I need time, we need time to get that strength back and start it again.
That's Sarah Sultani and Kamal Ahmed. I'm inspired by both, by their courage, grace, passion for education, and determination to bring about change. I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode of Out of Office. Remember, you can find more episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, the Bloomberg Terminal, and Bloomberg.com. This episode was produced by Laura Carlson. I'm Malika Kapoor. Wherever you are, I hope you're well. Thank you for listening.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.